Good morning. My name is Mark Silver, and today I'm going to be presenting a CLE called Psychosocial Evaluations and Consultation in Civil Litigation, Strategies to Understand and Humanize the Client. The idea today is to help civil litigation lawyers, particularly those who are focused on medical malpractice, personal injury, and so on, to have a tool at their disposal that will help them better evaluate the client, the client's claim of harm or injury, and understand clinically how that evaluation can help better advocate for the client given the civil litigation issues. This is crucial for plaintiff's lawyers. However, we also today want to include defense lawyers so that they have a better understanding and even insight into the kinds of harm, the quality of harm, that the individual is claiming to have suffered as a means to better defend their own client. I have been working in forensics for about 18 years now. I've done about 2,000 cases, primarily for immigration and criminal lawyers, but in recent years also for civil litigation lawyers. My background is both law and mental health as a psychiatric social worker with a background in psychology and systems theory. And the idea is to humanize the client as much as possible, to get at clinical issues. And this is something that I really picked up at literally the first day of law school, and certainly within a few weeks, how we read cases and we look at statute and case law. And so often we're grappling to understand the human aspects of the individual's claims, whether it's in a civil litigation case or a criminal action or whatever it might be. And what I've tried to do over the years is undertake psychosocial evaluations for lawyers throughout the United States to gain clinical understanding about their own issues so that in turn, my work can complement and balance the work of the lawyer, whether it's plaintiff's lawyer or defense lawyer, as a means for the lawyer to have a tool to better understand the client and his issues. The book on point here is something that came out just a few weeks ago. It's called Psychosocial Evaluations and Consultation in Civil Litigation. And it's available, like everything else today, on Amazon. The idea is, as the subtitle says, strategies to understand and humanize the client. So often in law school, we're not given the tools or any tool to help us understand clients. And it reminds me of my third year seminar in law school where we had to do a mock evaluation for a civil litigation case. And what I realized from other students in the seminar that didn't have any clinical background was that they simply didn't know what questions to ask. They simply didn't know what background issues regarding the client's psychosocial history may or may not be relevant to understand the client's issues and claims, and also, interestingly, what might not have been important, what may have been tertiary. So I highly recommend this book. I just published it. It really has a chapter by chapter, easy to read. Each chapter is just a few pages, understanding about how to undertake psychosocial assessments, what they are, the clinical issues and the challenges, and some of the major stumbling blocks that lawyers might encounter with clients in these kinds of cases. I try to integrate as much as possible theory with practice. And for that reason, I really encourage you to send me an email. My email is marksilver1@cs.com. Put in the subject line personal injury or personal injury two, and I will send you back a redacted copy that really tries to integrate the material from the CLE and the slides today into a real forensic case that I did. I have a few samples, actually. The only thing I ask is please, because I get a lot of spam, put your full name, address, phone number, and everything in the email so I know you're real. I'll be more than happy to send you back a redacted sample. I'm not gonna send you back spam, I promise, but I just need to weed out to make sure you're a real attorney. The idea in the redacted sample is for the lawyer to be able to read something that shows how the psychosocial evaluation is reflected clinically. And these evaluations look at a person's background, family, development, interests, hobbies, community contacts, and so on, challenges, and of course, any traumas of any kind the individual may have encountered as a means to understand who they are. Similarly, you know, in criminal mitigation cases, which is for pre-sentencing, we do also psychosocial evaluations to understand how this person got themselves into so much trouble. In personal injury cases, we want to know how this person functioned, what was their quality of life like prior to the injury or harm that they endured, and how, in any way, it has now changed, right? How, because of their past history, have they now suffered deficits in their everyday functioning, quality of life, as I mentioned, and so on. This really comes from my own background. I have done, as I said, hundreds and hundreds of evaluations for harm issues for immigration lawyers, and I've done something similar for criminal lawyers. But really, the idea here is to apply it for civil litigation in a wide range of areas. As I mentioned, obviously, the two most central are personal injury and medical malpractice, but I've actually done one or two employee-based cases, healthcare issues. It could apply to spousal abuse and so on. And really, just to reemphasize, this is not just for plaintiff's lawyer. It is also for defense lawyers. And I saw this myself as a law student one summer. I interned for a plaintiff's medical malpractice firm, but another summer I interned for the New York City Law Department in torts in their civil litigation defense. And clearly they needed, as much as the plaintiffs, a way to understand and evaluate and ask questions, whether it's at depositions or at trial, about the client's history to get a better sense of the claims that the individual has made. I would also emphasize that the American Bar Association came out in 2012 with a very interesting resolution. It says that lawyers in civil litigation and so on really need to consider non-legal supports that will help clarify and represent the client in a more complete way. And this is actually an early chapter I have in my book, and it's the argument that, we as lawyers are not given these kinds of tools in law school, and in some areas, extra legal support is necessary and sometimes even required by law. In New York State, for example, you can't pursue a medical malpractice claim without an affidavit from a physician in a similar area attesting to the validity of the injury by the plaintiff. And that's a very well-known, but a very important example of an extra legal support needed to pursue a medical malpractice claim. Similarly, we want extra legal sources such as psychiatric social workers, psychologists, and so on to be able to provide background psychosocial clinical histories in a forensic context as a means to really understand the client more. So I want to get into the heart and soul of how we understand the client, and that is through the psychosocial evaluation. The psychosocial evaluation is a gold standard used in all mental health to understand people's background psychosocial histories and so on. It's really a biopsychosocial evaluation. We call it psychosocial for short. Bio meaning we also consider biological, physical, and medical issues that the person may have suffered. And certainly a child may have had a very serious injury in childhood that could have affected them later on, or an adolescent playing football, for example, could have had neurological damage during a football game, during practice, and so on. So medical issues as well. And this is to determine if there are any factors that the client has in their histories that'll help us understand who they are based on their strengths and weaknesses, based on their vulnerabilities, and so on. We want to understand childhood stressors, traumas, major challenges. We want to understand the general experiences of the child. We want to understand the quality of relationships to immediate extended family members, sometimes called family dynamics. We want to know if that is an individual who grew up in a home where there was hugs and kisses and warmth, or if this is an individual who grew up in a home or community where there's hostility and dysfunction. We also want to consider the overall health and well-being, as I mentioned before, in terms of biopsychosocial, but also in terms of psychopathology. For example, children and adolescents, while it's more unusual, they can have very serious issues related to depression, anxiety and other mental health disorders. We want to understand the person's interaction with their environment and community and so on, their history of employment, socialization, and ultimately, this is all, as I mentioned at the outset, to humanize the client. This is how we understand individuals. The more details we get at the clinical level about the person's psychosocial history, the more we understand the person. And there's something else very important about this. And that is, the more we understand and have details of the person and write about it in report, the more other people are able to empathize and sympathize and identify with different aspects of that person's life. In other words, if you get a very broad outline of someone's life, it's not very meaningful. But if they tell you very detailed stories about traumas or challenges, or even detailed stories about major accomplishments in their lives, academically or otherwise, you will be able to relate and understand that person on a much more human level. I have a slide with regard to the major psychosocial issues we look at. Obviously, they're very wide. If a person, for example, has been in the armed forces, well, clearly, we want to focus on that because we're a country with a constant war, unfortunately, and a huge number of people who've gone to serve in the military, and we want to know about their experiences and if they've suffered trauma. Clearly, if a person has not been in the military, that's something we need to dismiss. But there are other areas that are very unsure. For example, abuse. We may see someone for an evaluation. They seem to be functioning very well and doing well in their vocational sphere, interpersonally and in the community and so on. But in fact, they have suffered very serious abuse when younger, but they have adapted or they've gone to therapy or they've been very resilient psychologically. So we don't want to dismiss any areas of psychosocial evaluation because we never know what kind of issues may come up as very relevant. The psychosocial history should be garnered within and particular emphasis for family, culture, and community. It's very important to get to know the person and do the psychosocial evaluation before they suffered harm or had major problems in their lives. Many of these clients do have obviously positive and happy memories from their early developmental years, and sometimes it's quite strategic and helpful to start with very positive memories. I see, for example, hundreds and hundreds of spousal abuse cases, and I often start asking questions from a very early age, not from the person's marriage, because often in childhood, the person has positive memories with regard to playing with siblings and going to school and hobbies and interests, rather than starting with the trauma related to the spousal abuse, which can be very overwhelming. So these are crucial areas to ask about in the psychosocial assessment. And they're particularly crucial because ultimately, we're trying to create a narrative that's clinically ensconced in details of the person's development in life. As I said at the outset, far and away, this is a strategic tool, not only for the clinical evaluator who's doing the forensic report, but it's also a strategic tool for the lawyer who can garner a way to understand issues about their clients. And one of the ideas that we really try and get across here, but also in the book, is that, you know, you're clearly not going to hire a forensic evaluator for every case, although some people do. And obviously it's for strategic reasons. But we also want the lawyer himself or herself to understand that even though they don't have any clinical training, they can certainly use this kind of strategy to better understand their client in the absence of getting a forensic evaluation, either because the client can't afford it or for whatever reason. And it's a way of talking to people and getting information that really helps to elicit crucial material about their background. And once that's accomplished, the lawyer can sort of act like a clinician in a sense. This is very similar, for example, to people who do mediation in divorce and other areas of law, where they come out of law school and they don't have the tools and they take a certification in mediation. I actually did that myself a few years after law school. I don't do mediation, but it just provided me further understanding about how people deal with conflict. And I then had a tool after completing the mediation course to be able to better intervene and assess what kind of issues are keeping these people at loggerheads during really traumatic periods at the height of the divorce process. Again, while this is really focused on plaintiff civil litigation work, clearly defense lawyers can also really use this at different points early on to understand the claims, but also clearly to ask questions directly to clients during depositions and to lock them in regarding their own background issues and how their background does or doesn't affect or hasn't been affected by the current harm that's going on. So I want to go over a little bit about the purpose of the psychosocial evaluations as a means to better understand the client. First and foremost is that professional expression can replace self-expression, and this is absolutely crucial. And by this I mean clients sometimes come off the street, they're recommended by other people, they want an evaluation by me, and I always say, go to a lawyer. Law is counterintuitive. There are ins and outs that you need counsel for and direction. There could be new case law and so on. Similarly, clients don't have the clinical ability to express their own cognitive and behavioral and mental health and emotional and psychological issues. Even clients who know themselves sometimes don't want to express their issues because they're too painful. There could be overwhelming psychological trauma from years before and for other reasons as well. And the whole point of the evaluation is to elicit from the client key clinical issues that they themselves wouldn't be able to express that they may not think are even perhaps important. And a great example is, you know, I've seen a lot of clients who have grown up in very impoverished areas. But because everyone was impoverished in their community, they did not think of it as particularly serious or deviant or whatever. And yet the poverty had profound effects on the individual's development, had profound effects on the individual's relationship to their families. Many of these clients had to forego their educations at young ages to supplement their parents' meager incomes, and so on. So sometimes clients themselves, even though they may not be aware of it, they may have suffered all sorts of important traumas and challenges and barriers in their lives at earlier ages that really they themselves can't express clearly. I had a case many years ago. It was a woman who had been terminated from her position at a high-end fashion store. She claimed because she was Black, and she had grown up with a family that flew all over the world. Her father had an international position. She had met people from different cultures and so on. And she really viewed herself as a person of the world. It was really a wonderful background that she experienced, a wonderful education in that way. And when she suffered discrimination in the workplace, it was the first time that she really viewed herself as an individual given her skin color, given who she was because of her ethnicity and so on. And as I said, she was really a person who saw herself as very equal, and she felt very comfortable with herself, with her ethnicity, her background, and so on. And she didn't have an appreciation of the fact that discrimination is a very real part of human existence. Bias and prejudice, these are real serious issues. And it really came out much more fully through a clinical evaluation because of her psychosocial history that we took. Okay, another major issue is clearly that this is not a mental health report. Clearly, all of the clients who have suffered harm or injuries have in some way suffered reactive issues such as depression and anxiety, and sometimes even post-traumatic stress disorder and so on. However, we're trying to really understand this person in a holistic way, okay? We're taking a systemic clinical history to understand them as best as possible as a means to include not just mental health issues or what's called more formally psychiatric issues or psychopathology, but to understand their daily functioning and well-being and health and their quality of life. So for a person who, for example, because they've suffered an injury, can't access the community in the way that they previously did, that may cause them significantly more harm than perhaps the personal injury itself or some medical consequence that results from it. Next is the single document theory, which basically says that, you know, in law, the other party, opposition, often given all kinds of documentation with regard to vocation and education, family history, community issues, and so on. And it can be helpful sometimes to have within the forensic report just this single document of, let's say, 20 pages and integrate key aspects of these other issues that can help explain the client's issues in life and so on. Another major purpose that we try to focus on is, and this is crucial, disabuse parties of bias and prejudice. So for example, and this is a key area of research in the 20th century, professionals, for whatever reason, have biases and prejudices just like everybody else. And we don't want to allow false assumptions to move forward. To the contrary, we want to be able to fill in the gaps. We don't want the other party to make any assumptions about our client's current life or about their history. We want to be able to present an empirical, that is a clinical, immediate understanding about the client now and also their history, without any regard to the client's gender or the color of their skin or anything else. The classic story I always give in criminal court is you see someone come in a jumpsuit and they're coming right from prison for a hearing. You just assume they've done something wrong if they're in a prison jumpsuit. There's something about their clothing. Similarly, someone comes into court in a $2,000 Giorgio Armani suit. There's a prejudice thinking, you know, this person is wealthy. And there is frankly much less sympathy given to someone who comes in with a $2,000 Giorgio Armani suit because it's assumed they're rich, they're privileged, and they've had every opportunity. So we want to disabuse the parties of assumptions and biases, and we want to dispel non-existent patterns that may seem evident. Finally, you know, sometimes evaluations are used just for theoretical purposes. That is just to help the lawyer conceptualize the case or as a strategic consult to better understand clinical issues or how to work with the issues, and just perhaps to find out if there are not other issues besides the primary injury or harm that the individual has suffered. And this occurs in more cases than you'd think. This is particularly true in employee-based cases where a person obviously is first and foremost concerned that they have been terminated wrongfully for one reason or another. But in fact, the termination may have had all sorts of secondary effects with regard to, you know, the quality of life or psychological issues that are just important. This occurs particularly with individuals that have been employees in a place where they've worked for 20 years and they feel, you know, this is really part of my family. I identify with the place I work. And the person may even have a relatively menial labor job. But it turns out it's not just the termination and the loss of wages. And obviously, loss of wages is extremely important issue. We don't want to minimize that. But the person's identity may have been very tied up with their job, their self-esteem. I see this a lot for professionals. I've had a lot of cases of nurses, interestingly enough, who all their lives they wanted to be nurses, often because younger siblings were ill. And it's not just a professional career, which is wonderful, but it's a core part of their identity. It's how they maintain their self-esteem. So the idea through all these purposes and so on is to create a clinical narrative, very much as a videographer does, but we're doing it from a clinical perspective. That is, we don't want just a journalist to go in, although some journalists have done amazing jobs taking background histories. We want everything to be within the context of something clinical. So the fact that someone, for example, going back to that issue, who grows up in an impoverished environment, we don't just want to, as a journalist, to document that there was poverty and the person perhaps only ate one meal a day, there wasn't electricity or indoor flush bathrooms, and they didn't have clean water, all that serious. We want to know the impact clinically on the person's life. We want to know how it is.
Esquire CLE's first verification code is GEL, G-E-L, all lowercase. GEL. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's first verification code is GEL. G-E-L, all lowercase, GEL. Please take a moment and write this down.
Affected their development with regard to their behavior and cognition, that is how they were thinking and thought processes. And we want to know what it did to their psychological development and emotional development. So the goal, as we stated, is to humanize the client through a sympathetic narrative. The goal is to allow the client's issues from a personal perspective based on their psychosocial history to come through in a much more emphatic way. The idea then is for the client's sense of security, the client's sense of safety, stability, those things that have allowed the client to feel content and happy in their lives, we want to know how that's been undermined. We want to know how their sense of security in their life has been jeopardized as a result of the injury or the harm that they've now suffered. The most important thing, and this is particularly true for children, but also for adults to some extent, to experience a sense of predictability in their lives, right? To have a sense of certainty. And in many of these cases, what we see is that because of a particular harm in these civil litigation cases or an injury or accident, whatever it may be, the individual has fundamentally had the ground shifted from underneath their feet because of this issue, and they no longer have that sense of predictability. The things that they have taken for granted every day in their lives, and this includes very simple day-to-day issues, may now simply not be present anymore. Clearly for the client and clearly for the lawyer, this is to maximize just compensation. And obviously for the defense lawyer, it's to minimize compensation. And it's a reality that we need to work with within that system. So a huge issue is who should evaluate these cases. The general rule is that these are very serious cases and they're pointed at a specific issue and they therefore need to be evaluated by someone who has a sensitivity to what needs to be asked to elicit information. And so someone who has clearly a history in forensics and this kind of realm, particularly psychiatric social workers who think very holistically, could be very helpful. Psychologists obviously do this work as well. They tend to be a little bit more narrow in their evaluations, focused on behavior and cognition. It tends to be less holistic in nature. Obviously, psychiatrists also do these kinds of evaluations, but psychiatrists are very focused on psychopathology. And one of the things you want to do in a harm case, or for any case for civil litigation lawyers, is look not just at psychopathology, as I said, but much more broadly at anything and everything that helps us understand the client's background, so that that anything and everything will help us understand how that person's quality of life today has fundamentally changed. General mental health practitioners or therapists are usually very poor. There are all sorts of reasons, they don't want to do these evaluations. They don't know how to do these evaluations. If they see a client in therapy for whatever reason, they don't want their notes to become available for litigation purposes. Many therapists are just very worried about liability issues. And it's also an orientation issue that I really need to explain. And the best example I always give is for spousal abuse victims. Many of these individuals have suffered physical, emotional, psychological, verbal, sexual abuse, and so on. And if they see a therapist, they will be talking about issues at their readiness. In other words, the best example are individuals who have suffered sexual abuse. It may take weeks, months, or even years to really talk about the sexual abuse that they've suffered because it's so painful, shameful, and humiliating, and so on. It's such a terrible thing. Forensics is exactly the opposite. In forensics, there are areas that need to be covered in spousal abuse cases. And within an hour or two or three, you need to ask these questions. They can be painful questions and uncomfortable. And the client needs to be made aware of it. but the forensic expert is not doing his or her job unless these questions are asked, because otherwise we may miss really crucial areas of trauma that could really help enlighten the case and explain the person's harm in various ways. Another major area that I just want to mention, it's not usually talked about, is something called psychodynamics. Psychodynamics needs to be integrated into the psychosocial evaluation, and it's something that was very predominant in the United States from about 1920 to about 1980. It became much less predominant because in the 1950s and 60s, psychopharmacology came in, that is medications for depression and anxiety, and particularly for psychosis. And the theoretical orientation of psychodynamics really went down. But it is absolutely crucial because it provides the interrelation of the unconscious and conscious mental and emotional forces. In other words, there are many clients we see who, you know, they present with a strong outer exterior. And you scratch just beneath the surface and you see someone who's quite fragile, and vulnerable. And we want to know why they are so fragile and vulnerable. And it's because of who they are as a human being. It's because of their sense of self, how they understand themselves in relationship to others. It has to do with their self-esteem and their personal identity, self-concept, and so on. It has to do with their sense of loyalty and trust with other people, and how in so many of these cases, their sense of trust has been undermined because of the harm or the incident that's occurred. It's very important to understand that it's not only a sense of trust in others. Many of these clients, and this is a very interesting area to understand, their own judgment is sometimes impaired. In other words, the client has gotten into a situation, and this is particularly true in spousal abuse cases, but all sorts of other areas as well, where the client not only becomes distrustful of others, but the client thinks, well, how did I get myself into this situation? In other words, the client becomes distrustful of their own judgment. And if they become distrustful of their own judgment, it really means that it has a fundamentally negative impact on their self-esteem and on how they see themselves and so on. Clearly, many of these clients have suffered shame and humiliation. Obviously, it depends on the kind of civil litigation issue. It depends if, you know, obviously this is a person who steps into the street and they're hit by a car. It's just a terrible accident and there's no animus involved by the defendant, and the client who's been harmed simply made a mistake by stepping into the road. Perhaps it was even a red light. But there are other situations where there's shame and humiliation, such as if there's termination from the workplace, which is a huge area of civil litigation, such as if there is a claim of sexual abuse in different scenarios, and certainly in spousal abuse cases that I see very often. Another key area of psychodynamics, and this is so helpful for lawyers, is to understand how the client is strong and how they're able to cope in a very positive way and defend themselves from anxieties and trauma and so on. And similarly, how they are not strong, how there are perhaps deficits in their lives or challenges or weaknesses that they have based on their psychosocial history. In other words, this is a person perhaps who has suffered trauma as a child or adolescent or maybe even young adult, and that trauma has eaten away at their ego defenses, and they're much less able to defend themselves against anxiety and all these kinds of problems. So psychodynamics helps us to get at the fears and sadness, anxieties, jealousy, fantasies and frustrations and confusions. It helps us understand who we are as human beings. It also gets at, and this is really important, our hopes and ideals and our values. And those are very important because in so many cases of personal injury, medical malpractice, and so on, some of these hopes and ideals and values of our future are put on hold or jeopardized or permanently lost because of the injury or harm that we've suffered. It's just a great area. It looks at disappointments, instabilities, uncertainties. It really gets to us at a very fundamental, helping to describe who we are as human beings. One of the best cases, and I'll just mention this quickly, was an individual who was severely harmed. He was an individual, and I think I've mentioned this before, who had been helping customers from a major store with groceries, bringing those groceries into the car, and security in the parking lot thought that he was up to no good. And they detained him and assaulted him, causing severe damage to his legs and so on. And this was a first-generation immigrant from Mexico who was here with his wife and two American children. And he came here with hopes and ideals and dreams, leaving behind an impoverished background in Mexico where there was terrible violence and alcoholism. And he was here leading a very good life as a first-generation immigrant. And everything about his life in just a few moments was taken from him. It's not just that he suffered these devastating physical injuries to his legs and knees and so on and needed a fantastic amount of work, including surgeries and rehabilitation and PT and OT and so on, but that everything this person had tried to escape from in Mexico, all of the hostility and problems and all of the negativity from his family and community of origin that he had left behind for very positive reasons to get better jobs and to ensure that his children would have a better education in the United States, were in a few moments completely lost. And it just permanently undermined everything this person had ever looked towards and ever hoped that he could have, not only for himself, but just as importantly, for his wife and his children. And it really showed how his injuries, which also physically also harmed him clearly, robbed him of his personal sense of dignity and independence and so on. These are core issues you get at in psychodynamics. It's not really very complicated if you understand the kinds of questions and issues involved. And it's therefore very easy to elicit the kind of information that I think is really the most sympathetic and empathetic and really gets to the core of who we are, not just as human beings generally, which is important in a universal way, but as individuals. A huge area when taking psychosocial assessments is what is true and what's not true. And many clients, of course, want to over-exaggerate narratives in an effort to bolster a weak claim, and they may under-exaggerate a narrative because the person fears that the truth is simply too terrible to hear. So, you know, over-exaggeration occurs where there is injuries where the person tries to embellish the injury, such as a back injury or a neck injury, as a means to gain greater compensation. And it just doesn't really work very well, clearly, because the person's examined by a physician. And more importantly, clients are not very good at presenting issues that are not true. And you want them to present things that are empirical and true, and not just for the integrity of the case on a legal level, but for a clinical level to really be able to understand them. Similarly, clients who under-exaggerate a claim, and these are individuals, for example, who suffered sexual abuse in the workplace, they just don't want to talk about it because it's so painful. These are also clients I've seen a couple times who have suffered, you know, civil injuries, such as, you know, a client who's hit by a car, and it has profound effects on their ability to have enjoy sexual intimacy with their spouse or partner and so on. And, you know, you see a client who's perhaps from a very conservative or religious background, and they're just very uncomfortable talking openly about their sexuality and their preferences sexually with their partner and so on. But these are extremely human, important elements of our lives that need to be elicited from the client. So we do, in fact, have a clear narrative of all the issues that really affect the person in a fundamental way. And for one person, you know, the loss of that sexual intimacy can be much more important than the loss of a job, because perhaps the job as the person had, is relatively easy to gain again because they're perhaps very educated or they have an excellent resume. They're not really worried about gaining another job. But perhaps the loss of the sexual intimacy is something that is just fundamentally harmful and a terrible loss to their lives now and perhaps for many years going forward. clients who are presenting harm issues, especially from months or even years ago, sometimes don't have detailed memories. Detailed memories tend to occur when there's something that is exceptional or out of the ordinary, that is especially when there's a trauma. It also tends to occur when we have something that is qualified. So in other words, perhaps a client had suffered abuse in the workplace for many years, secretly behind closed doors, but one day there are comments made by the abuser in front of other coworkers, and the victim feels a deep sense of shame and humiliation, and it's an instant of abuse that the plaintiff simply will never be able to forget. And finally, there are some things that are impossible to forget, such as physical scars because of an incident of violence.
Conceptualizing harm. And this slide is absolutely crucial. It really, hopefully in this single slide, summarizes what we want to do. And that is we want to conceptualize harm very broadly. We want to conceptualize the harm the person suffered earlier in their life, interpersonally, within their community, and so on, and clearly within the context of the current issue at hand. We want to understand and conceptualize harm with regard primarily to themselves, their, you know, the dignity that they've lost, their identity, how their self-worth has been undermined, how their sense of security and safety has been jeopardized. These are crucial issues in conceptualizing harm because it reflects quality of life issues. The next thing we want to do is conceptualize deficits and losses in their everyday life. And these can be very broad, or these can be very specific. They can have to do with, you know, the client negotiating within their own apartment because of a physical harm that they can no longer access their sink or attend to their activities of daily living, which may include shopping and cooking, or even personal hygiene, washing oneself and going to the bathroom. I had a client who was helping customers in a major supermarket put their groceries into a car after they had been shopping, and he was attacked by security officers in the parking lot of the shopping mall, parking lot, because they thought he was harming the customers for some bizarre reason. It was really a race-based case. This guy, when he was attacked, suffered profound harm to his legs and his knees and so on. And he's relatively young. I'd say in his mid-30s, he had two or three young daughters and his wife. They were recent immigrants to the United States, a wonderful family. And he was not able to work, and he was not able to walk, and he obviously needed a lot of physical rehabilitation and so on. But what he said was the greatest harm that he suffered was personal hygiene. I said, well, what do you mean? He said, when I go to the bathroom or take a shower, I need help from my wife and my daughters, who were relatively young, 5, 6, 7, 8. He said, you know, I'm a man. I feel so humiliated for myself personally, and I feel terrible that I have to put this burden on my young wife and my daughters who have to see me in this position. And it was just a great example of, you know, this is a guy who's going to have, you know, years and years of rehabilitation, hoping he will walk again, and he probably will never gain correct ambulation because of the damage to his legs and his knees and so on. And therefore, he can't work and he can't support his family. Those are all, you know, crucial issues, I'm sure, to the plaintiff's lawyer. But for this client, what's most important is just grabbing a shower like a normal adult. For this client, it's being able to get up and on the toilet to attend to one's personal bathroom needs like a normal adult. So conceptualizing harm broadly is important, but also for the particular person. I also look at cognitive losses. You know, here, cognition is important. How a person's ability to process information has been harmed, how their memory has been harmed. How their ability cognitively to negotiate their environment and use these tools and to recognize spaces and to interact with people, all that stuff has to do with conceptualizing harm. Conceptualizing harm very broadly in the community, negotiating the community. I had a client who couldn't negotiate the community for certain reasons, the harm, He couldn't take public transportation. If he ultimately had to move, he was a wonderful community with extended family and so on. That was a major harm. You're looking at privations and losses to conceptualizing harm, socialization loss, and so on. Also losses with regard to hobbies, activities, and interests. You know, I'm an individual. I have very few hobbies and activities. I love tennis. It's a huge part of my life. I've been playing almost every week for God knows how long with the same partner. And, you know, and if I couldn't do it, some people would say, well, look, not playing tennis, that is not the end of the world. But to a person who has a particular hobby or interest that's really important to them, it really serves as a major holding block to who they are because of their personality or for whatever reason. So really looking at the person at a very individual level can be very important, and things that may not seem very important to you may be very important to that particular person. And you almost have to pick up rocks and look under rocks for conceptualizing harm, because harm, just like positive supports, can exist and pertain to almost everything and anything within our background and within our lives. The types of harms that a person can suffer are also crucially important. I just want to go over them very quickly because we have a lot of material. But there are physical harms, psychological harms, emotional harms, verbal, sexual harms, financial harms, privations, withholding, religious harms, technology harms, and so on. And there's obviously a very clear need to sort of focus on the first two, physical and psychological harms in personal injury cases. But really, you know, the person may have suffered other kinds of harms for other reasons that could be very central. I'll tell you a quick story. I had a case where this guy was a Holocaust survivor from Eastern Europe. The Holocaust, of course, was the program in Germany that ultimately led to the deaths of 6 million Jews, among others. And this guy was in his apartment in Brooklyn, New York, and a guy came over to help us setting up the internet, and there are all sorts of cables in the home. And my client is a difficult person as a result of the trauma he suffered many, many decades ago. And he said something that sort of ticked off the technician. And the technician said, well, and I don't know if the technician said this in a joking way or whatever. Obviously, I wasn't there, but he said, you know, I can string you up by the cords used for the, you know, the internet hookup. And, you know, that's obviously a horrible thing to say to anybody. But this is a client who had suffered this horrific abuse in Eastern Europe during the Second World War. And to hear him, to have him hear this kind of a thing in his own apartment, where he's been so secluded because of the traumas he suffered earlier in life, was just devastating to him. It just triggered for him the most awful memories. So there was no physical harm. He did not feel threatened in any kind of traditional sense. But in that moment, that verbal abuse really spoke to the worst racial prejudices that he had suffered earlier in life. It's important to also look at functioning over narrative. That is, you know, sometimes you see clients who get up in the morning, they go to work, and they seem to be engaged in hobbies and activities and so on. But the truth is that person really has deep problems. They're deeply depressed or anxious or whatever. So the fact that someone can be engaged in their daily life doesn't mean that they don't have very serious problems that need to be understood. And conceptualizing harm in terms of functioning can be very important, just as we want narrative to be very important. That is, we want to understand the client's narrative in very important and clinical detail. Understanding the reason for the harm can be very important as well. Reason for harm could pertain to something very specific or something very general. Clearly, if you walk onto the street from the sidewalk as a pedestrian, you're hit by a car, one would assume that the car has hit you because they have no particular animus towards you. And it's just an arbitrary bad turn of events for you as the person who has been injured. But you want to understand the relationship between the plaintiff and the harm person, if possible. In other words, the plaintiff and the person that committed the harm can maybe have a very intimate relationship, as we see in spousal abuse cases or in more general cases. there's this very interesting case. This woman was working at a church, and she became pregnant, and she was asked to leave. And she was just terribly traumatized. She was a single woman, unmarried, and she became pregnant. She was working in an administrative position. She was traumatized not because she was asked to leave, apparently. She was traumatized because she felt she was part of the church. She felt she had an immediate and trusting relationship with the people who worked in the church. And so she was devastated, not just in terms of employment, but as a Christian, given her relationship to these individuals. That's also seen in workplace harms. You know, you work in a place for months or years, and you think you develop this warm relationship with colleagues and your boss and so on, and then something happens, a form of abuse, often verbal or psychological or emotional, and you're so devastated because in your mind, you've developed this very close relationship with the people you work with. Now, objectively, someone may say, well, that's ridiculous. These are not your family members, these are not your friends, these are colleagues, and you need to understand appropriate boundaries. But you have to remember that we're looking from the perspective of the plaintiff. We're working from the perspective of the person who suffered harm, and it's very subjective. So one person, you know, may be working, you know, in a factory for 10 years, and they develop no important relationships with colleagues and bosses and so on. They just do their stuff, and they go home, and they have their own lives. And another person may go to their factory and work every day, and that is their family. They're isolated home, and they have no family and very few friends, and they love going to work, not just for the work and the employment and so on, but because that's where they socialize, and that's where they talk to people. They love their lunch hour. And to be to suffer harm in that context by a colleague or boss or whatever can be emotionally devastating for that reason. Sometimes there are no patterns, sometimes there are patterns. These are things that can be relevant in the psychosocial evaluation in understanding what occurred and in understanding the effect in the short term and in the long term that this may have on the person. And of course, this goes back to what we mentioned, we learned this in law school, the eggshell rule, which states the proposition, take the plaintiff as you find him. That is, the psychosocial evaluation is the tool to understand how we find the plaintiff, the person who suffered harm, given their immediate context and given the various harms and issues that they've experienced at earlier developmental points in their lives, even from their early childhood onwards. And this, of course, may include someone who has a predisposition to mental health issues, a person that may have suffered terrible psychological or emotional trauma because of an incident. It may have triggered issues because they were they had a predisposition. So we're looking at ways in which people may be very vulnerable or fragile given their history. So too, the opposite. A person may have been very strong before. A person may have been very independent and self-sufficient without any history of mental health or psychological problems, and they have become devastated through this particular issue. So unrecognized harms is also important. I sometimes talk about this. The best example I give is radiographic assessment. That is, you know, someone gets into an accident. I've been in a lot of bike accidents. I drive my bike. And, you know, you sometimes have an accident. You think, yeah, I'm fine. And, you know, you get back on after a few minutes and you get up your courage. You get back on your bike and you drive home or wherever you're going. And then, you know, 2 days or 2 weeks later, you feel something weird in your back or your neck, and you go for a CAT scan or MRI, and you find that something serious has occurred. In other words, there may be physical injuries that are not evident, and therefore you get radiographic evaluation. So too with individuals psychologically, emotionally, and so on. A person may say they're well, they may say they've had a very pleasant history, but you know, you sort of pick up the rock and you look underneath and it turns out they have a history of trauma they didn't want to talk about, or something very may have been very normative. And I do a lot of immigration cases. The best example is I see a lot of clients who grew up in poverty and, you know, they don't have enough food to eat and they've grown up in third world countries without enough electricity or clean water. And, you know, it sounds just terrible. These are basic necessities that people take for granted here, but they don't have them, my clients, in their country of origin. And I say, well, what's going on? And the truth is the clients say, you know, that's how everybody lived. Everybody lived in poverty. And they see it as normal in their earlier years, so they don't talk about it as any kind of serious issue or as a harm. One of the things I really want to emphasize is that harm...
Esquire CLE's second verification code is ZOO. Z-O-O. All lowercase. ZOO. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's second verification code is ZOO. Z-O-O. All lowercase. ZOO. Please take a moment and write this down.
Harm suffered to family members who are not plaintiffs, who may not be in this case, is crucial, because it gives a reflection about the client's functioning and health. If I ever want to know about how a guy's doing, I ask his wife. And what I mean by that is other family members provide huge amounts of insight with regard to the person's functioning and well-being. It's like having another brain in the room. It's like having another set of eyes understanding and giving feedback about how that person functions in their home and community, interpersonally, vocationally, and so on. We also want to understand if the harm the person has suffered has harmed other people, because again, it reflects back. And the classic case I always give in lectures is what I mentioned before, who this guy who suffered a debilitating injury to his legs and knees, who then couldn't care for himself for his personal hygiene and bathroom needs and showering and so on. His children were devastated having to help their father and, you know, seeing him naked in this kind of situation, which is, you know, just awful, which reflects back to the client and reinforces his own psychological, emotional harm. There are a few caveats. I just want to mention them very quickly. One is that a single incident of harm can be systemically damaging to an individual. That is, a single incident of harm can really harm people in ways that are not immediately obvious, and that's why we need to conceptualize harm broadly, because a single incident can spider out into various areas of a person's life. Another thing is that people perceive and affected by harm in very idiosyncratic ways. The classic story I give of my grandparents 50 years ago, they had a terrible car accident. They went down this hill, and my grandfather walked out of the car without injury. He never drove a car again. My grandmother, thank God, walked out of the car without injury. She went and started driving the car the next day, had no problem. Because they're two completely individuals. My grandfather grew up in Eastern Europe, a child of the First World War, having suffered terrible trauma, and he was very risk averse, very conservative in his life. My grandmother grew up in Connecticut. She grew up in a poor home, but it was safe and loving. And she was a person to take risks, and she was a person to feel very free in her community, within her family, and so on. So individual perception is crucial. Resilience is also crucial, understanding a person's ability to overcome adversity, and also understanding reasons that people may not be able to overcome adversity based on their past harms. It can be helpful to understand intergenerational harm, which concerns how parents and grandparents perhaps have suffered harm in various contexts, and how that now affects the client in his or her position. We want to break down harm and understand the individual causes. And lastly, we want to understand if it's a single incident of harm, such as a car accident, or if it's sustained harm that may lead to complex trauma. And this is something I talked to another CLE, but the best example is a child, for example, who's grown up in a home where the child over many years suffers many incidents of physical abuse and emotional abuse and verbal abuse. That is called complex trauma. It's not a single incident. It's repeated, and it can have profound neurological and negative emotional long-term effects on the individual. In the time we have left, I just want to note a few of the major psychiatric issues that can affect the individual. Clearly, we look first and foremost at PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, which means that a person has been in a situation where they've been exposed to death or threat of death, or where they've experienced serious injury, or they have a fear of serious harm or injury because of what they've experienced. This is very idiosyncratic, and I'll give you a great example. I had a race-based case of a woman who was working for this fancy store in Florida, where she was fired, she claimed, because she was black. This was an individual who had done fantastic in her professional career. She only had a high school education. She had risen to become manager of this really well-known store, high-end clothing. And I really believe she suffered fear for her personal safety, not that there was any risk to her immediate physical safety in terms of harm, but fear in terms of her ability to lead her life in a healthy way based on what she perceived to be this racial prejudice because of the color of her skin. And I did think this was a case of PTSD. Many of these clients have intrusive symptoms such as bad dreams or nightmares. Many of these clients are unable to forget the memories associated with the harm. And for many of these clients, they try to avoid things that remind them or will trigger memories of the harm or abuse that they have experienced. And as a result, many of these clients may have a distorted sense of the world. They may feel chronically unsafe and insecure. They may blame themselves. These are clients who don't want to participate in things socially or within the community and so on. And they may have persistent constricted affect, meaning they don't really feel enjoyment. They may even have anhedonia, which is really by definition the inability to derive pleasure from daily activities. And these clients may have hyperarousal symptoms, which mean they may become irritable or angry. They may have difficulty with sleeping and appetite. They may have exaggerated startled responses and so on, and poor concentration. Clients may have some of these symptoms, all of these symptoms, and it's really important to look at the individual given their particular history. Many of these clients have suffered depression, and you know, one thing that I've tried to stress is that, you know, the fact that a client goes to work every day and they, you know, they may go to the gym and so on, it doesn't mean that they're not depressed. There are many, many people who take their own lives through suicide, who in the days and weeks before have been leading a relatively normal life, and family and friends are just shocked. They're eating their meals and they're going to sleep and waking up on time, and they're interacting and they're responding to emails and so on. It doesn't mean the individual is not depressed. And yet clearly I've seen clients who suffered harm who really demonstrate clear and obvious symptoms of depression, including crying and isolation and so on, and even suicidality, which is on the next slide. And this is crucial. These are individuals who suffer, you know, chronic sense of helpless despair and deep psychological pain. As I said, it can be chronic. It can also be acute. Suicidality refers to active, where a person has an active plan to take their own life, such as by ingesting pills or shooting themselves or jumping from a bridge. And there's also passive suicidality, where a person may think, gee, it's better to sleep and sleep and sleep and never wake up so my psychological pain will go away. Some of these clients become habituated with their pain. Some of the suicidality is based on self-hatred. They may feel they're a burden to others. What's very important about suicidality, and one of the reasons I like asking about it, is it really gets to the core of helplessness and psychological pain and despair and so on. And it reflects something very fundamental above and beyond symptoms related to what we just noted, which was depression, sadness, and so on. Many clients also suffer panic attacks after harms. This is because usually something triggers the panic attack, such as, for example, seeing something that reminds them of the harm. Panic attacks can be very wide-ranging. They often involve, you know, accelerated heartbeat, palpitations, sweating, trembling, sensations of shortness of breath, choking, abdominal pain, dizziness, and so on. And many of these clients fear that they're going to lose control, they're going to keel over, they're going to die. It can be very acute. It can be very frightening. Some of these clients have panic attacks late at night, and they think they're just bad dreams. They're probably night terrors, and they have many of these same symptoms. Clients sometimes think they're having a heart attack. They go to the emergency room and they get a cardiac check. Panic attacks are actually not that unusual. They're often associated with phobias and other anxiety issues, and they should be asked about. Somatization can be very important. This is chronic psychological issues that cause bodily symptoms, including pain. And the symptoms can't be traced back to physical cause, and they may not be the result of substance abuse. And you have clients that have suffered psychological and emotional harm, and they develop back pain and neck pain, even though they haven't had any accidents or personal injuries. And their psychological issues are manifesting themselves in a physical or a somatic way. And the clients may become very preoccupied with these physical symptoms to the point that they go to specialists to see, such as orthopedists, or get MRIs to ensure that they don't have, in fact, literal physical medical issues, but that really this stuff is rooted in psychological and emotional problems. Some clients feel a deep sense of helplessness, which goes back in part to suicidality, as I mentioned, the depression rate feel, a deep sense of, you know, shame or humiliation having been harmed for one reason or another. They feel worthless about themselves. They may blame themselves. They may feel guilty, guilty that they got themselves into that situation, or guilty that they're really burdening other family members because of their sense of powerlessness and because of how their lives have changed and how perhaps they've had to lead very different kinds of lives in the aftermath of the harm that they suffered. Some clients, although unusual, they do suffer psychosis. They may have hallucinations, which are false perceptions, such as hearing things that aren't real, and they may have delusions. Delusions are false beliefs. It could be adaptive paranoia, for example, where for self-protection, a person, because they're so guarded and suspicious and they have such a low sense of trust in others, they may find their mind playing tricks on themselves going down the street, and they think they hear their name being called, but really nobody's there. Psychosis, which is basically a fancy word for being out of touch with reality for one reason, is more common than you think and occurs in cases of trauma. I see many clients, for example, who've suffered harm, who become hypervigilant, right? This is a word that we use as a symptom in post-traumatic stress disorder. They become hypervigilant. They're always looking over their shoulders. They're always guarded. And one would imagine that as a result, psychosis may be an issue. There's this famous quote from Johnny Caravella, "When everybody's out to get you, paranoia is just the next logical step." If you've been harmed repeatedly and your self-esteem has been assaulted and your personal sense of safety and personal integrity and so on, it makes sense that you would perhaps adopt this kind of stance psychologically and neurologically as a means to defend yourself. Some clients may develop a dissociative disorder. That is, clients, especially those who have been sexually abused, you can't fight because the person is too strong. You can't flight. You can't run away. You disassociate. You sort of have your mind remove itself from its immediate place of harm to somewhere else as a means to defend yourself against this overwhelming anxiety and fear and so on. And that's something that is not usually asked about, but can be relevant. Many of our clients actually have a history of drug or alcohol problems, sometimes many problems, and they don't want to be asked about because they're worried it's going to harm the case. But again, ask about the person's use and abuse of drugs and alcohol and non-traditional substances such as household products, because it can give a lot of insight into the person's history. And maybe the person, for example, has used alcohol socially for many years, but now they've come to abuse alcohol in the last few weeks or few months as a way to self-medicate because they haven't sought professional help. And this will help them deal with the harms that they've suffered emotionally and psychologically. Some clients suffer a factitious disorder. This is something that is a major concern. These are clients who are not feigning. That is, they're not faking symptoms, but they deliberately develop symptoms of a physical nature so they can gain a psychological or emotional health. Clearly, there's a sense by defense lawyers that the client is faking, that they're malingering, which is mean that they're developing symptoms and problems that are not true just to gain pecuniary benefit, such as money, obviously. And that's something which is also in the back of the mind of the evaluator and obviously a point of concern. Looking also at subclinical issues and atypical issues and cultural sensitivity is very important. Cultural sensitivity can point to how a person normally adapts in one kind of situation, but within their own culture, within their own family, there may be a particular way that the person behaves or adapts that may be very different from what we're used to, and it needs to be asked about. And this includes atypical presentations. Exactly what I've mentioned, meaning that some people may react in situation A in a particular way, and we may find that, in fact, very generally. But this particular client, given his particular history and his particular cultural context, may react and cope with problems in a very different way. Please be aware that many of our clients have not sought mental health assistance because they're ashamed, or psychiatric care is anathema to their background, or mental health diagnoses are stigmatized. They may not have the resources. And for many reasons, these clients may have suffered real psychological or emotional harm within their psychosocial context currently or by their history, but they have never sought help, and therefore they have very little insight. They're not psychologically minded into their history of clinical problems. Well, what I've tried to do today is provide an overview for civil litigation lawyers as to how to better grapple with a person's harm claim by considering their psychosocial background from a clinical and developmental perspective, using this model to better then conceptualize various kinds of harms that the persons may have suffered, both generally and idiosyncratically, given their personal history and who they are and how they see the world. And this ultimately will help us better understand their psychological, emotional, personal, and community interaction, and also with consideration clearly to specific psychiatric issues that we've noted in this program. Thank you very much. And again, please don't hesitate to send me an email. I will send you back a copy of a redacted case so that you can see how theory is integrated into practice. I also noted my book that has very specific chapters on these issues. And hopefully this has been of help for you today. And thank you for listening.